home is the smell of your hair. I would give up the howling gales of the steppes to listen to you breathe. All the stars in the sky, all the fallen corn guiding us through the night, could not compare to the brightness of your eyes when you looked at me. Your eyes were wide, so wide, like campfires burning. There are certain moments that tie themselves into your soul, like a mother beating felt into the walls of the gear. They hammer themselves into you. So it was then with you in my arms and no one around to watch us. So it was then when you flushed the color of cherry blossoms. So it was then when my heart hammered from being so near to you. The two of us may well have been statues, for neither of us could move. My neck felt hot. My hackles rose, and suddenly my lips were so dry. I just had to lick them. And yours were red. Red, red. Fireworks shot off between my ears. Touching you made me wonder when you were going to leave me in a pile of cinders. I felt in my bones that I had to be nearer to you, that I had to consume you and let you consume me. When we parted, I went as cold as a corn night. We spoke to hide the crackling of our emotions. We did not speak of what had happened to your parents. I will not repeat the details here. In all the years since their passing, you've never mentioned them. You keep a shrine, of course, in your rooms, a piece of your mother's war mask sits next to a scroll of your father's poetry. Every morning you kneel, you light incense, you speak prayers in hushed tones. The shrine was there when I arrived that day, and I have no doubt you've taken it with you to your current holdings, wherever that may be. No, we did not speak of your parents. You asked me what I'd done out on the steps, and you chided at me for my awful handwriting. 4 years away from me, and this is what happens? You said, holding one of my letters. All my hard work is undone. Though I laughed to boost your mood, I shifted in my seat. I knew what the letters said. I could recite them from memory. But reading them... I opened my hand and closed it. Maybe I was just dumb. You furrowed your brow. Chevalier, you said, is something the matter? As if I had anything to worry about. As if your parents had not just died. I shook my head, but you weren't having it. Chevalier, he said, I do not have to tell you to be honest with me. I cannot lie to you, and you must be the same. We are the same. You reached for a brush, inkblot, bowl, and paper. They were always within an arm's reach of you, as if you might wake in the night with a powerful urge to practice calligraphy. I want you to write my name, you said, and do not stress too much over it. I want to see something. Do not stress over it, you said. The finest calligrapher in Hokkara wanted to inspect my handwriting, but it was nothing to stress over. Breathe in. Raise brush. Make the stroke. Then breathe out. Except that line didn't look right. What did that symbol look like? I racked my mind for it. How many times had I seen your name? I bit my lip. You were staring at me, at the paper. By then I was trembling. I added another line. That wasn't right either. With my free hand I took hold of my braid. What did your name look like? He squeezed my shoulder. All right, he said. He reached for a sheet of clean paper and set that out in front of me. Now, in corn, I want you to write everything I say, starting now. I inked the brush and waited for you to begin. You stood, got on your tiptoes, and picked up my bow. My name is Barzilai Shefali al-Sharia. My favorite hobbies are hunting, shooting things full of arrows, and sitting quietly at dinner parties. My best friend is the illustrious O Shizuka of Fujino, imperial niece, and the finest swordsman to walk the earth since Minami Shiori. Together we are going to slay a god. But first, we are conducting a simple test. I like horses, especially gray ones. By the time you finished, you grinned from ear to ear. I was fighting off a smile myself. The whole thing was so silly. There you were in a morning dress, doing a terrible impression of me, and there I was, taking down everything you said. Yet, when I looked down at the parchment, there was every word. No false starts, no terrible handwriting. You leaned over and studied it. You knew enough corn to make your conclusion. I think, you said, that you cannot write Hokarin. You did not say this as an accusation. Somehow hearing someone else say it relieved me. I nodded. When I write to you, your friend Dorbente reads it for you, you said, and you tell her what you wish to say. I made no motion to argue. You studied me for a moment. I worried you'd say something dismissive. Do you think, you said, we could write Hokarin words in the Korn alphabet? Would that be easier? I tilted my head. But the Korn alphabet was much simpler. It did not have as many letters. That was the whole reason I liked it. Yet, the more I thought about it, it was possible, if we added one or two more letters. Yes, I said. Very well, then, he said. I tire of Hokarin characters anyway. A change of pace will be welcome. I found myself grinning. I spent so long worried what you'd think when you'd pieced it together. He smiled a soft infant smile and sat down next to me. Long hours gave way to night. It occurred to me I did not have anywhere to stay in the Imperial Palace. Before I brought it up, you called for your servants and commanded them to bring up an additional bed. Not to prepare another room. Oh, no. You wanted a bed brought into this one. I pointed out the hallway. Was there not another room we could use, one with two beds? For your answer, you waved me off. We stay here, you said firmly. Though I thought it unjust, what you were doing to your service staff, I said nothing. There was a certain look about you. Had you left this room since the incident? You must have. This was you. This was Oshizuka, flower of the Empire. You wouldn't lock yourself away to wilt. Except that pile of papers on your desk, tall as a helmet. The more I looked at your dress, the more wrinkles I saw. You slept in it. Your hair free of ornaments, your fingers stained with ink. You hadn't left your room. In all this time. Shizuka. Moments before this, you had sat on the painted bench near your bed. Now you bent in on yourself like a branch bearing too much weight. For tonight, he said, we stay here. A strange thing happens when one speaks aloud. Words take on their own meaning. They move in through the listener's ears and make themselves home, decorating their meaning with whatever memories they find lying around. And you did not want Shizuru and Itsuki to leave you just yet. So as you broke down, as your shoulders shook with the force of your tears, as your breath came to you in shallow gulps and gasps, I held you. These are the finest rooms in the palace, you choked out. I put a finger to your lips to try to stop you from forcing yourself to talk. You batted my hand away. You fought to sit upright, but you were too dizzy to keep it up for long. My uncle picked them out himself. Your tears soaked my deal. I ran my hands through your hair. I took a deep breath of your perfume, hoping I might siphon some of your sorrows away. But it did not help. Nothing helped. Though you opened your trembling mouth, you could speak no more. So I rocked you back and forth for what seemed an hour. When the servants came with my bed, I pointed to an unoccupied corner of the room and dismissed them, rather than let them see you. So I lay with you that night until you fell asleep. I did not bother changing out of my deal. When Grandmother Sky's golden eye peeked in on us, you were turned toward me, your head nuzzled against my chest. I woke before you. Hunters wake before dawn as a force of habit. As a lotus petal floating on placid water, so you floated on the bedsheets. Your dress spread out around you, your hair a black fan against white. No traces of worry, no traces of sorrow. Only peace remained on your features. Looking at you in the morning light, Shizuka, watching you sleep, it is like cresting a hill and finding a valley sprawling before you, full of flowers, teeming with life and colors you cannot name. I was awestruck. And in the back of my mind, I wondered when your hairline got so bright, when your lips became bows, when the daughter herself painted spring onto your cheeks. I touched your cheek, and I immediately disturbed your sacred slumber. Your eyes fluttered open. Dawn cast them gold. "Chevalier," you muttered. I sat up quick as I could, hoping you were too sleepy to notice I was gawking. Why was I gawking? I knit my brows together. Why? Why was I so fascinated by your face? You lurched up and rubbed at your eyes. What time is it? I held up two fists, one finger raised on the first and two on the second. The first hour of the second bell, you said. You pulled the covers over your head. What are you doing awake? I shrugged. You could not see me, but I shrugged. You are a fool, you said. A fool who needs her rest. Go back to bed, Chevalier. We will have to go to court today. The idea of spending even more time mired in etiquette and propriety was less appealing than riding for 10 days straight, with no saddle and no time for breaks. But you needed me. So I swallowed up my discomfort, my trepidation, and thought of how miserable you'd be if you had to go alone. A bit past second bell, servants woke us. They gathered around you like moths to a flame. A dozen hands undressed you and redressed you. One girl carried the white dress away. Another brought in a vibrant blue gown. Peacock feathers adorned the collar and sleeves. The back of the train bore iridescent paint in gold and green and black. One of the girls held a tray of crushed gems properly treated. You dipped your fingers in sapphires. I was fascinated by it. Every one of them had a different job, and they all set about doing them at the same time. Like worms making silk, like women weaving. Your face they painted pale white. On the back of your neck, two sharp blue points. On your forehead, gold leaf shaped into a peacock feather. By the time they finished with you, the Shizuka I grew up with was gone. In her place was a young empress. In her place stood the daughter made flesh. In her place, the image of spring. In her place, the sky and all her splendor. The servants surrounded you and bowed. You held one hand up and dismissed them. "Now that my armor is ready," he said, "I suppose we will have to face my uncle." You fixed me with your amber eyes. "You will keep me company." I was in the same deal I wore yesterday, the one my grandmother made me, embroidered with colorful shapes. I hadn't bathed in a week at least. My hair was greasy, my braid a knotted mess. I smelled like horses and rotten milk. "But you wanted me to go with you to see the Emperor." I flapped my deal's collar. You came closer. With your shining fingers, you reached for my braid. "You rode all the way from the steps," you said. "If anyone chides you, they will deal with me." You smoothed my deal. "Besides," you said, "this is a very fine coat." My cheeks flushed. I cleared my throat and nodded. It was then that I noticed you weren't wearing your sword. I touched the wide belt around your waist, then touched my scabbard. You covered my hand with your own. "If I wear my mother's blade," he said, "people will think it's an invitation, and I don't mean to get blood on this dress." Temurin accompanied us on the way to the throne room. So did a half a dozen Imperial Guard who did not speak to you. As mist in the morning, they appeared behind us. You paid them no mind, but I found myself glancing at them. Sharp crescent blades crowned their pikes. When did those come into style, and why did they need to carry them inside the palace when a sword would do? No blackbloods wandered the imperial halls, no demons. "Barzilai," said Temurin, eyes darting behind her, "these men have been standing outside Barsatok's door all night." I crooked a brow. "And you, too?" Temurin frowned. "That's not the point. They were waiting for her to leave. 6 men to guard a single girl. 6 men in full armor with pikes indoors. I do not like it. This is not an honor guard." One of the guards spoke, rattling his pike as he did. "All conversation in the Imperial Palace must be conducted in Hokarin as the gods intended." He must not have known very much about us if he thought that was intimidating. "The gods are not stopping us," he said briskly. I see no reason for a tall boy in armor to stop us either. You will cease interrupting my companions. You did not look at them as you spoke. Instead, you kept right on walking, your shoulders back and your head held high. Oh, Shizuka-san, we are under strict orders. Your orders do not concern me, you said. Your manners do. If the guard had anything more to say, he bit his tongue. The path to the throne room was long and winding. I followed you, walking just behind you, and fought the urge to keep your dress from dragging along the ground. Surely something that costs so much should not be exposed to dirt. But you did not seem concerned about it, and neither did any of the guards. The courtiers we saw on the way were another story. There are so many. For every 20 steps you took, another begged your attention. Young magistrates, old lords and ladies, generals and diplomats. Anyone who laid eyes on you wanted to speak to you. Oh, Shizuka-shun, they'd call. You grace us with your presence. May we come to court with you? You may not, you would say, and you would keep going rather than entertain their arguments. What of the fine silks they could send to you? What of the dress they'd sent for, just for you? What of the jewels? What of the poetry? They were nothing to you. And so you kept walking, leaving only the scent of your perfume in your wake. When we entered the throne room, a gong rang. Before its brassy ring finished sounding, one of the servants announced you. Oh, Shizuka-shun, daughter of Oitsuki Lore, and O Shizuru Moore enters. May flowers sprout in her steps. You flinched at the mention of your parents' names. Then, in an instant, the look of despair was gone, and only your imperial mask remained. As well it should. A warrior might put on a mask of bronze to face demons and blackbloods, but to face these jackals in men's clothing, one needed a different sort of protection. No, come to think of it, I prefer jackals. At least they are honest about their hunger. The people milling about the throne room that day had the same desperation in their eyes for you, the same bright avarice. Yet they had the nerve to smile to you, to bow when your name was mentioned. But for the moment, you ignored them and turned your attention to the young man by the gong. Crier, you said. You did not announce my companion. I shifted. Did I really need to be announced? I did not think of myself as a noble, at least not the learned Hokara noble. I passed no exams. I received only minimal tutoring. My father did not teach me how to run my lands. Indeed, being no Shiro too long chafed, my name meant nothing to these people. The corn, said the crier. He studied me and Temurin both, as if trying to decide which one of us was more likely to be a barbarian. Oshiro Shefali, daughter of Oshiro Yuichi and Burkila Alshara, he said. Strange to hear my mother's child name coming from anyone but your mother or my grandmother. Most of the time she was that woman or that demon. The crier stiffened. He clenched his jaw. Seeing him, I felt my stomach twist. Either my mother killed part of his family or he was a racist. Or perhaps both. I did not wish to deal with either. You narrowed your eyes. Just behind you, some courtiers were coming. You did not have much time before you had to brush them off. Is something the matter? You said. The choir could not lie to you. Lying to the blood of heaven was like lying to the gods themselves. But he could not insult me either, since I technically had a higher status than he did. And so, however bitter his qualms, he swallowed them. Oshiro Shefali-san, he said, daughter of Oshiro Yuichi-tor, may her life be long and peaceful. It was then that the courtiers approached you, a middle-aged man with a topknot and his young wife, in black and yellow. Fuyutsuki province, then. Were they the lord and lady? I did not know. Both of them wore a honeybee crest on their clothing. I racked my mind. Had I seen it before? A dull ache dissuaded me from thinking too hard. Oh, Shizuka-shun, said the man. We are pleased to see you. It has been so long since you attended court. Was it that crest that was bothering me? I felt a darkness in the room, a wrongness. When Whenever I took a breath, the back of my tongue tasted terrible. I ended up holding my breath rather than deal with the nausea. "We are sorry for the loss of your parents. They shall be missed," said the woman. "Owitzki Lore's work immortalizes him." Perhaps it was the environment. All the courtiers together, speaking their honeyed falsehoods. Why did I feel as if I'd caught the scent of a tiger? Again, you flinched. "Thank you, Fuitzkiton," he said. "Wasn't that the lowest form of address for a lord?" "Have you met Barsalai, sir?" And a third-degree honorific for me. "Shizuka, sometimes I wonder how you did not invite duels from everyone you met." Fuyitsuki appraised me in my worn-out deal. His wife didn't bother. "Are you Yuichi Tool's daughter?" he said. "I've heard stories about you." I said nothing, simply nodded. I did not like being in the spotlight. "Oh, Shizuka-shun," said Lady Fuyitsuki. "You know you are always welcome in our lands. My son Ketchi is about your age. I'm certain you'd enjoy dueling him." "I would enjoy defeating him if that's what you mean," he said. Lord Fuitsky laughed. It was a loud, pompous sort of laugh. One single, "Ha!" "Is there anyone you cannot defeat?" Next to me, Tamarin grumbled. "Those Hakarans and their simpering," she said. "Barsalai, must we stay for this?" "Rastatok asked," I said quietly. Tamarin crossed her arms. I did not blame her. In her position, I'd do everything I could to leave early. Expansive though the throne room may be, it still had a ceiling. "I do not need to describe the throne room to you, Shizuka. You know its secrets better than I do. Its 100 jade columns are as familiar to you as the rivers and brooks of the steppes are to me. Golden tiles line the ceiling, lending everything a brighter look. Braziers shine like alarm fires. Around the perimeter of the room is an undulating jade dragon statue. I'm sure you tried to ride it as a child. In the center, near its yawning head, is the dragon throne. On it sat your uncle in imperial green. Next to him, one of your three aunts. His first wife, nearing 42 now, gray hairs tucked behind her ears like flowers. The current Lord Shishiki was her nephew, if I remembered correctly. My father liked to ramble about her when he'd had too much to drink. "Now there's a woman," he'd say. "The beauty of a phoenix, cunning as a fox. Oh, Yoshimoto Tono is in safe hands with her." What was her name? Sand slipping between my fingers. Only the image of my father's drunken face remained, of his pale gold cheeks flushing red, of the glassy look in his eyes. He and the Empress knew each other as children, thanks to my father's friendship with your father. Maybe they played together as we did. He did not speak of her much except when the liquor got into him. I lost track of the conversation while staring at the Empress, at the woman my father so prized. What few wrinkles she had only emphasized her handsome features. Not that it was easy to focus on her face. Where you were cloaked in peacock feathers, the Empress wore genuine phoenix feathers, passed down through the imperial line for ages. The slightest movement sent them swaying. Bright red, deep crimson. Dawn's gold and dusk's orange trailed in their wake. I could not look away from those feathers. Each plume bore a single green spot, almost like an eye near the top. I found myself leaning toward them. As the smell of fresh brewed tea incites thirst, these feathers in sight. I could not be sure. My fingertips tingled. My forehead felt hot. What was it like to touch them? Would they sear my flesh? And yet I knew I had to have them. And when I glanced down at my hands, I saw it there in my palms, and all around me were thousands of candles in different shapes and sizes. And my hand was not my hand. It was gray and twisted and topped with sharp claws. "Barsalai," said Tamarin, "you gawk." Clearing my throat, I tore myself away. Lord and Lady Fuitsky left our company while I was busy making a fool of myself. Only you remained, your hands tucked into your sleeves. You looked down your nose at me. "Shefali," you said, "you are as bad as my suitors." Suitors? I grimaced. We were 13 and you had suitors? Your parents had just died, and you had suitors? Do not be so surprised, you said. Venom crept into your voice as you glanced around the room. I saw them now, the men standing by the jade columns, looking over to you just often enough. Demure smiles, dangerous eyes. 3 wives in, and Uncle has not conceived a child. They are fools who think they can use me to get on the throne. You kept going back to one of the men. He wore white and bright green, the colors of Shiratori. He was not tall, but he bore himself as if he were, all broad shoulders and puffed-out chest. Night-dark hair pulled into a horsetail complemented the shadow of beard on his chin. At his hip hung a straight sword with an elaborate jade hilt. Something about him soured my stomach. Have you ever seen a sick dog, Shizuka? Have you ever seen it shamble about, frothing at the mouth? Have you seen ticks coating a dog's flank, so many and so fat that they look like mushrooms growing on a tree? So I felt when I looked at him. He made my teeth hurt and my ears ring. 5 times you looked at him. Each time you shivered as if something wet crawled down your neck. Do not, you whispered. Let him look at me. I stood in front of you to block his view. Kornheit had its advantages. In the entirety of the throne room, only Temrin and a handful of guards were taller than I. I made it my duty to know where that man stood at all times, and as you went about your business entertaining conversations with people you did not care about, I stood between the two of you. For the barest of moments, you slipped your hands free of your sleeves and your fingertips brushed against mine. And then I felt 2 pinpricks of heat on my back. I reached for the bow I left in your chambers out of habit as I turned. I was careful to keep you behind me. He was there, so close, shorter than I was as a 13-year-old. I was struck by how clammy his skin looked, like raw fish. Beads of sweat collected on his forehead. When he smiled, his teeth were painted black. Fashionable 2 decades ago. Strange. He was no older than 30, by the look of him. He bowed and his coal-fire eyes met mine. I did not allow myself to shiver, but the hackles on my neck rose all the same.
Oshiro's son, I take it, he said. I do not believe we've met.
I fought the urge to bare my teeth. Tamarin took a step closer to me, 1 hand on her scimitar. The man glanced at her and scoffed.
Shizuka-shun, he said. You should call off your dogs.
Instantly you pushed in front of me. Though you were cloaked in peacock feathers and sapphires, you burned with anger.
Call me that 1 more time, Kagamori-yon, you snarled, and I will show the entire court just where you belong.
Yon. I'd never heard that one before, but only the brothers' titles started with that sound. But Kagamori did not flinch. He laughed once as a man laughs at a child's flailing.
And where is that Shizuka-shun? He said. What ferocity! Did you slay the tiger Shizuka-shun, or did you switch souls with it?
In the years to come, many people would write about this moment. They'd swear they saw you draw a shimmering sword from the light itself and point it at his throat. I've seen paintings of it, you know. None include me. Some include Temurin. Temurin is more important to the story. For it was Temurin's scimitar you drew, Temurin's curved blade catching the gold light of the throne room. To say you drew it in the blink of an eye would be to do you a disservice. 1 moment you were empty-handed, the very next you were not. The sound of steel rang throughout the gilt room. Guards moved in, their pikes lowered, forming a tight circle around us. You kept the sword leveled at Kagamori's throat.
Oh, Shizuka-shun, are you all right?
Called the guard captain. I have been insulted, he said, and disrespected by this foul excuse for a human being. At once, they turned their pikes toward Kagamori. He sneered. What a willful child you are, he said, drawing steel in the Emperor's presence.
Uncle, you shouted.
No one addressed the Emperor. The proper thing to do was to wait for him to speak in any given situation. But you have never been one for waiting. Your uncle bristled. He did not rise from his throne.
Instead, he waved a hand and the guards stepped back. The other courtiers went quiet in anticipation of his holy words.
Shizuka, he said, you have demanded our attention. Out of respect for your father's memory, we shall allow it. But you are to keep a closer guard on your tongue in the future.
Each syllable was heavy, each word formed according to the most formal rules of Hokkaran. This man refers to me as a child, you said. He speaks to me with familiarity he is not and will never earn. He has not heeded me when I have told him to leave me alone. I demand the right, granted me by our divine blood. I demand a duel. As a stone dropped in a puddle sends out ripples, so you sent out waves of hushed whispers through the crowd. Kagamori, still held at sword point, knit his brows. Your uncle did not stand. To stand would show too much emotion. Nor did his wife have any visible reaction, save to reach for one of the phoenix feathers and stroke it.
You cannot be serious, your uncle said. You are 13. He is a grown man.
3 months ago I faced older men and soldiers, you said, your voice crackling with pride. My age was not an issue then. It should not be an issue now. I am worth 20 of him with one hand tied behind my back and blindfolded. I demand a duel. This was the first I'd heard of it, but then it had been 3 months since you last wrote to me. You must have been composing the letter when...
That was a tournament, Yoshimoto intoned. One your mother did not wish for you to attend.
Uncle, do not speak to me of my mother's wishes, you snapped. Sky save you, you were snapping at the Emperor. Did it at all matter to you that he ruled Hokkaro? If my mother were here, I would not be asking your permission for a duel. I would be watching his body be dragged from the throne room. I demand a duel. The silence in the room was like glass shattering. I longed to touch you, to give you some sort of reassurance, but you stood in front of me, and all eyes were on us. I could not touch you without further sullying your reputation. Instead, I whispered your name so low, only you could hear it, and I swear I saw the taut muscles of your hand relax. Uncle, you repeated, your voice calmer. If I am old enough to receive marriage proposals, I am old enough to duel. Yoshimoto said nothing. The Emperor is supposed to be serenity made flesh, but in your uncle's doughy brow, I read nothing but anger. The Empress leaned over and whispered in his ear. He said something sharp and cutting to her I could not hear. She spoke again, more timidly this time. Finally, he sighed.
Very well, he said. If you so insist, Shizuka, then we shall grant your request. You may duel to first blood in the courtyard.
So the courtiers filed one by one out of the throne room. Still you stood before Kagamori. Still you held the blade to his throat. He bared his blackened teeth.
There was no need to bring the Emperor into our little lover's quarrel, he said.
Lover's quarrel? He spoke in such a way to a 13-year-old girl. I growled at him. His eyes flickered over to me and he scoffed.
I did not know your dog spoke Hokkaran, he said to you.
Get to the courtyard, you roared, before I behead you where you stand. Another soft laugh. As he stepped away, he hummed to himself.
If you insist, he said, it will not change fate's path. You will be mine one day, Shizuka-shun.
Only you, I, Temurin, and your guards remained in the throne room. Even the Emperor had departed on his palanquin. You bit your lip. I will kill him, you said. Not today, but one day when I am older, I will kill him. I squeezed your shoulder. Next to us, Temurin shifted from foot to foot.
Rasalai, I may not speak rice tongue, but I know a challenge when I see it. Does Barsotok need our assistance? Say the word and I will gladly use him to test my arrows.
You gave Temurin the respect of looking at her when she spoke, though you did not share a language. I was going to ask you if you wanted us to help you in the duel, though I had no idea how that would work when you spoke to her. Guard, he said, I do not know your name. Brasilai will tell me soon, I am sure. I thank you for the use of your sword. Temerin, I said, pointing to her. Then I tapped the sword with my fingers. She can keep it if she likes. I have more, and she does not seem to have any, Temerin said. You held out the scimitar to Temerin, pommel toward her. She slipped it back into its sheath. You, tall boy, he said, pointing to the guard who chided us before. Go to the courtyard ahead of us. Let it be known that my mother's sword is to be prepared for me. This order chafed him, but it did not stop him from taking off at a run. Then you began walking. The halls rang with the clacking of your wooden sandals, but not your voice. So many twists and turns, so many identical portraits of this emperor or that emperor. How is one fat Hokaran different from any other fat Hokaran? Couldn't they dress differently at least? But no, each one wore the same dragon scale crown. Each one sat on the matching dragon scale throne. Each one was fat. Each one was pale. Each one had the same forced serenity painted onto his face. How, I ask you, did you tell your ancestors apart? To this day, I cannot navigate the palace without you. I do not know how anyone can live in such a place, with walls and ceilings and hallways of identical men staring at you. Cages are for animals, not people. So it was to my great relief when we entered the courtyard, the opposite of the labyrinth you just led me through. Here was a forest in miniature. Here peonies in all the colors and patterns known to man blossom on tree branches. Here rows and rows of chrysanthemums swayed in the soft morning wind. A single tall white tree grew in the center, almost as tall as the palace itself. Around it, a small pool of water glittered in the sunlight. At the northern end of the yard was a raised dais upon which your uncle and aunt sat. Everyone else picked a bench and staked their claim. I took a deep breath of the fragrant air and greeted Grandmother Sky for the first time all day. But then I saw Kagamori waiting just in front of the great white tree, and my prayers died unspoken. But you continued walking, and you stood 3 paces away from him, cloaked in your pride, armored in dignity. A servant scurried by me, a young boy so nervous he bumped into my knee on his way to the inner ring. In his hands he held a black lacquer box, almost as big as he was. He finally sank to his knees next to you and opened the box. Your mother's sword rested inside. The Daybreak blade, its sheath lined with solid gold and carved from finest ivory, an intricate sun on the cross guard, a crescent moon for a pommel. It was a thing of impractical beauty. How the Queen of Crows used it with any regularity baffled me. There was not so much as a single chip on the sheath. You reached for it and you took it in your hands, and I swear to you, I saw the cross guard flash. You stepped out of your wooden sandals and pushed them aside with one delicate toe, standing barefoot on the grass. Kagamori may have been taller, but you looked down your nose at him all the same. The crier, too, was present, and it was he who sounded the gong. O Shizuka-shun, daughter of Oitsuki-lore, challenges Kagamori Zul to a duel, he announced. They meet with the blessings of the Son of Heaven. Let the first shedding of blood hail the victor. Silence. Kagamori sank into a fighting stance and drew his sword, plain, unadorned, and antique in style. You did not draw yours. Indeed, even as he circled you, you did not draw your sword, nor did you change your posture. Next to me, Temerin crossed her arms. Rice-eaters and their rituals, she muttered. I shished her. For you were a coiled spring. Any second now he'd make the mistake of setting you off. Do you fear me, Shizuka-shun? He asked. Why do you not bear steel? I do not need to for the likes of you, you said, and you will not goad me into attacking. In the shadows of the great white tree, I saw him tug at the corners of his mouth, saw the disappointment on his face. What a quandary he faced. If he struck first and you countered him, this duel would be over in a single stroke. Minutes passed. A quarter hour he circled you, A quarter hour you stood unmoving, your golden eyes fixing him with feline malice. Your breathing was shallow and unnoticeable. Then he got tired of waiting. Then he raised his sword high overhead. A blood-curdling scream left his painted mouth. He ran toward you. And then, as a man lost in the sand signals to a passing caravan with a mirror, so you signaled your victory with the flashing of your blade. You drew your sword, slashed him clean across the face, and sheathed. One smooth motion too fast to follow with a naked eye, and it was over. Kagamori stopped. The sword fell from his hands and clattered to the ground. Red seeped from his wound like juice from a fresh-cut plum. "You do not deserve to hold a sword," you said. He screamed. "My face! You cut my face!" He clutched the gash as if it were a seam he could hold closed. A man in doctor's robes ran to his assistance, but Kagamori pushed him away, shambling toward you with one hand on his face. "You insolent brat!" "Insult me again," you said, "and I will have your tongue. You've been defeated. Continue your aggression, and I will not be so kind to you a second time." But still he lumbered for you. "My face," he muttered over and over. "You took away my face." Guards leapt rows of chrysanthemums, surrounding him within seconds. A ring of piked blades pointed straight at his throat. "Stop where you are," shouted the captain. "You threaten the Imperial family." "I threaten a puffed-up child," he snarled. "Can you not see what she's done to me?" "What sort of man enters a duel and expects to escape unharmed?" you said. As you spoke, your voice grew louder and louder. "A coward, a simpering coward. Your presence offends me." For a moment, you stared him down, one hand white-knuckled, holding your mother's sword. I glanced toward your uncle. How could he abide this in silence? And yet, he sat on his dais and he watched, and he did nothing. You spoke through teeth clenched tight. "Take him away." Guards tied rope around his hands. Roughly they dragged him away, likely to throw him into the infamous Hokkaran prison system. In the south of Fujino, a fortress nearly the size of the palace loomed like a noose at the gallows. In the days when your mother acted as the Emperor's executioner, the prisons were always empty. After her death, they began to fill again, and I do not envy the thought of returning to them. Your uncle will throw anyone in the fortress for any reason at all. With my own two eyes, I have seen a man hauled off in chains for having the audacity to call your uncle Iori, the name he was given at birth, the name he wore until he put on the dragon crown. I have seen women arrested for stealing a handful of rice. I have seen hunters locked away for killing the wrong color stag. Your uncle likes to say he is civilized, that your mother's death enlightened him, that he realized executioners were a base thing for an emperor to have. But there is nothing civilized about flinging someone into a dark room with no windows for the rest of their life. There is nothing civilized about letting them stew in their own excrement and beg for week-old bread. But I am only an illiterate brute. What do I know of civility? I watched him go. Already gossip flew from mouth to mouth to mouth. By nightfall, you would again be a legend. A girl 13 who struck down a grown man with a single stroke. Her mother's sword flashing in the light. Her daybreak blade come to life. More than one of them joked that you'd already slain a tiger. So a man was no trouble. You stood proud in the face of it all. As a sycophant after sycophant sang your praises, you nodded and smiled and thanked them in a distant way. For hours I stood by your side. When you needed a moment to yourself, you casually tapped my leg with your sheath, and I would pretend I had something to say in private, and so we'd steal moments from the crowd. "Bees," you muttered, "with their incessant buzzing. Why should a phoenix concern herself with the buzzing of bees?" I had some idea. Though your uncle did not speak to you, he made a point of looking in your direction. Every quarter hour, a messenger jogged up to you and whispered something in your ear. You never reacted well to that. "Too mouthy," you said to me after one such occasion. "Too unladylike. as if he has any right to define what a lady should be. I pressed my lips together. By the end of the sixth bell, purple fingers crept across that beautiful blue sky, moon reaching for sun. Courtiers began to make their excuses, wives waiting in their rooms, children who needed to be put to bed. Would they have the pleasure of your company should they wish to call on you? The answer, universally, was no. And you made no excuses when the seventh bell rang. You walked right out of the garden, leaving a collection of awestruck faces behind you. Your guards followed, as did Temurin and I. And so you led us back to your rooms where Temurin again waited outside. When the door closed behind us, you let out a groan. "Chevalier," you said, "I think I would rather live on the steps than let those fools nip at my toes." You sat before your mirror. With sharp motions, you removed the peacock feathers from your hair, removed the ornaments and the bells. These you set on your table. You yanked a cloth from its hook and wiped off your makeup. At least, you tried, though you swiped only once, smearing blue and black and green across your painted white face. But you tossed the cloth at the wall anyway, rather than continue. I sat on the bench next to you. You held your head in your hands and slumped forward, as if your skull suddenly was very heavy. "Meaningless," you mumbled. "Meaningless tripe. Our crops are blighted. Our livestock die in droves. Our fishermen bring up hundreds of terrible blackened things. Every day peasants gather outside the palace and beg to be heard. But instead, we let grown men harass 13-year-old girls. Instead, we parade about in our finest and do our best to ignore the problem. We will endure. What tripe." My throat hurt. My people, too, had seen such things. Wolves that did not die when we shot them, that did not stagger. Dogs that laugh like men in the dark. Some of my clanmates' horses died overnight, and in the morning only their heads remained. The rest of their once proud bodies was reduced to... It was like stew, raw stew meat left out in the sun to rot. I cannot describe to you the anguish on my clanmate's face when he discovered his horses in such a state. For days he screamed at the sun. Foul blasphemies left his lips. How could Grandmother Sky allow this to happen? She saw all, did she not? She sheltered the souls of the fallen corn on her starry cloak. Why did she not strike down the attacker with lightning? Because there was no attacker. Because dark things ride in the winds at night, while we huddled near our fires and pretended we were safe. Silence hung between us. You reached for my hand. Yes, that was lightning striking me dumb and deaf and blind. I was frozen in place by the slightest touch. "Chevalier," you said, "you and I will stop this one day. We will go north, where the black bloods go. And whatever it is we are meant to do, we will do it. Together, Chevalier, like two pine needles." Your smeared face in half a dozen shades, your hair not quite brushed, your eyes. From our childhood, you'd been saying this. As we grew older, you said it with more and more conviction, as if you spoke moving to Shishar. Difficult, yes, but doable. But you did not speak of moving across the sands. You spoke of finding your way north, where the traitor dwelled. And if I knew you at all, you meant to challenge him, as if he could not simply squash you between his forefingers like overripe fruit. But may the sky slay me where I sit now if I did not believe it more and more each time. I swallowed and squeezed your hand. Then I reached for the cloth you'd thrown away. I dipped it in a bowl of water on the desk, and I wrung it dry. I reached for your face. You did not stop me. Instead, you closed your eyes and let me wash away your mask. When I was done, only Shizuka remained. Only the finest sword in the empire. Only the finest calligrapher. Only the most... I shook my head rather than fully voice that thought. You were my best friend. I could not allow myself to think such things about you. I could not allow my heart to hammer as it did. I could not allow myself to dream about touching you. When you began speaking, I wanted to heave a sigh of relief, something to listen to other than my own thoughts. "My mother let me into the tournament, you know," he said. the challenge of the 16 swords, held every 8 years to commemorate the first challenge of 16. Being allowed to enter at all was a great honor. Each province was allowed only 2 participants. To think that the Imperial Fujino sent a small girl as one of their champions, I laughed. Oh, how I pitied anyone who crossed swords with you. For years I begged her, but all she ever did was speak to me of danger. My father pointed out the challenge is to first blood, and healers would be nearby. He pleaded and pleaded. Finally, my mother relented. As I wiped the last of your lipstick away, you smiled like a knife. And, of course, of the 16 finest blades in Hokkaido, mine is the finest. Ah, Shizuka, how I wish I could have seen it. How I wish I could have seen you strike down 15 duelists, 15 adults who prided themselves on their swordplay. Sometimes I imagine it. I've tracked down a few descriptions of that tournament, and I had Otgard read them to me. You must tell me one day if you really lopped off Ishikechi's nose with just the point of your sword. Was she proud? I asked. Your amber eyes darted toward the shrine. Your mother's war mask stared back at you. She was, you said. She called me a pompous show-off, but she was proud, I think. Before... You licked your lips. Before she left, she promised we'd begin lessons together. Gods, but that hurt to hear. Again, I squeezed your hand. And it was then I noticed you had a scar on your palm from the day in the woods, when we were 8, when I touched it with my fingertips. Together, I said. Together, you said. And you leaned your head against my shoulder, as if it were the most natural thing in the world. You slipped your arm around my waist. The smell of peonies met my nose. My lips went dry, and for a moment, I wondered what might be the right thing to do. I pulled you closer, leaned my head against yours. We held hands. Scars brushed together. I decided that I didn't care whether or not it was right, so long as I was doing it. How will I tell her? I could write to you forever about those heady days spent in Fujino. I could write of how silly I looked when you let me try on your dresses, how the billowing sleeves came just past my elbow, how none of your belts fit around my waist. I let you try on my deal. It was massive on you, pooling on the floor and around your feet. You left the collar mostly undone. I saw your collarbones, accents to the slender curve of your neck. I tried not to stare at them. I was fascinated by you, by your motions, by your expressions, the smallest details of your life. In the mornings you rose at the 3rd bell. After rising from the bed, you moved to your writing desk. In careful strokes, you wrote a line from one of your father's poems, first in Hokkaran, then in Korn letters. We'd read it together so that you understood the pronunciation and I understood how to read it. We took tea together. On the 2nd day, I realized you were not let out of your rooms unless you were going to court. You did not say it aloud. I suspect you did not want to admit defeat. And so you spoke of anything and everything except your parents. My uncle despises me, you said one night. I drummed my fingertips against the desk. He has not said this, but I know it to be true, you continued. He picked these runes for me. He summons me to court, but only after peasants have worn him thin. To him, you said, I'm nothing but a passing amusement, someone to write his edicts, I suppose. But I've seen the jealousy festering behind his eyes. I am never invited to dinner, never allowed to greet our people. As you spoke, you wrote another set of notices from what little I could read. You took no joy in this. You stabbed your brush into the water. He hopes people do not think of me, you said. Brush met paper. You took a deep breath, a single short stroke. 3 wives, you said. 3 wives, no children, no bastards running amok. Peasants call him the limp emperor. It came together in my mind. Without any children, You were the only Hokkaran heir. You were crown princess now. Rocks against your window. You ignored them. The dark clouds on the horizon were somewhat harder to ignore. To the north of Hokkaro, toward the ruined lands, inky clouds marred Grandmother Sky's skin. It was just the way of things. I shall be a woman soon, of proper age, and then no one will cage me, you said. Again, you spoke with certainty, but as your lips shaped the words, my heart forged them. Cages were not meant for people. 2 weeks after I barreled into the palace in the dark of night, my mother followed in my footsteps. It was past last bell when we woke to the clattering weapons outside the door. Corin's shouting reached my ears. "Stand down, you imperial dogs," Tamarin shouted. No one understood her, but she shouted all the same. When I opened the door, my mother stood outside, in her hand a bared blade, on her face a wolf's fury. Tamarin stood back to back with her. "Stand down," you shouted from behind me, and because it was you who spoke, they listened. With a snarl, my mother, too, sheathed her sword. The gesture she made couldn't have meant anything nice. And yet when she laid eyes on you, her whole manner changed. Waves of anger gave way to tides of sadness. Bittersweet joy replaced red-hot wrath. My mother, Burkila Alshara, the destroyer, the terror of the steppes, embraced you with a whimper. I watched her run her fingers through your hair. She pressed her nose to each of your cheeks, took a breath of you. Then she perched her head atop yours and held you so tight, I wondered if you could breathe. Tamarin watched with lips parted. I hugged myself a few steps away. Because I saw what Tamarin did not. I saw my mother whispering in your ear. I saw her scarred lips moving. Frozen in awe you were. Your eyes carved from glittering ice. Your skin turned to goose flesh. In the ages to come, drawings and woodcuts tried to imagine the scene. Most of them bear captions. It seems everyone has an idea of what my mother said to you. 1,000 purple promises, 100 boisterous boasts. I've seen some that make a joke of it. Yes, some people make a joke of my mother breaking her vow of silence. I left the fire pit alight. I would like to see that writer try to lead an army without making a single sound. I would like to see him raise 2 children without speaking to them. But the truth of the matter is this. My mother only ever spoke to your mother. The first time she broke her oath was during the 8-fold trial, when one of the generals imprisoned them together. As you well know, the most popular story goes that Shizuru kept cracking jokes about the prison needing more bamboo mats, the Minami clan being bamboo mat merchants at the time. My mother looked at her and said, "If we live, I will buy your mats." Shizuru told this story whenever she got the chance. I believe it to be true with my whole heart. To hear her tell it, the whole reason she never lost hope was that she had a hut full of mats to sell. But Shizuru could not tell that story anymore, and that was why my mother spoke to you. In a minute it was over, this moment frozen in my mind. The two of you parted. Only then did Alshara embrace me and sniff my cheeks. But she did muss my hair. Then she gestured that we should follow her. You laughed. "Alsharamor," you said. "I have guards." Among the many things in the chest pocket of her deal, my mother keeps a slate and chalk. She produced it now. In confident, if inelegant Hokkaran strokes, she wrote. I couldn't read it, of course, but you've told me this story so many times, I thought I might return the favor. "I am Burkila Alshara. Oshizuru entrusted me with the care of her daughter. If you doubt me, you are welcome to try and stop me. I've killed in front of my children before." She held it up so it was plain to read from behind you. You covered your mouth. Only my mother would be so blunt, so audacious. Yet still she stared each of the guards down, fingering the hilt of her knife.
"So the stories are true," said one of them.
He was smiling. Sky rest his soul, he was smiling.
"You use slate and chalk. What kind of warlord does that?"
"Kaito, don't be a fool," said another. As he spoke, his upper lip trembled. A certain smell filled the air. Acrid, warm, stale.
The same smell that filled any gear in the morning. Piss. A dark trail trickled its way down the second guard's pants.
When you broke down the wall of stone,